This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. If you've heard of today's guest, it's probably in the context of a heated anger exchange between him and students at Yale University that went viral in 2015. The students called for Nicholas Christakis, a sociologist, physician, and one of Yale's most respected scholars, to be fired after he argued that students didn't need official guidelines about picking Halloween costumes that might be culturally insensitive and offensive. Christakis not only held on to his tenured position, but 3 years later, he was awarded the Sterling Professorship, Yale's highest faculty honor. And his confrontation with students kicked off an ongoing national debate about freedom of speech, political correctness, and millennial sensitivity on college campuses. As a sociologist, the 56-year-old Christakis is no stranger to highly charged group interactions. His new book is Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society, which argues that our genetic makeup predisposes us to favor peaceful interaction and respectful coexistence over angry and violent mob rule. I sat down with Christakis to talk about his theory that what unites us as humans is stronger than what divides us, the power of evolution as an explanatory system for society, and whether Enlightenment values such as civil discourse and intellectual freedom are still respected at our nation's colleges and universities. Nicholas Christakis, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much for having me, Nick.
What's the elevator pitch of your book?
I think the elevator pitch is that for far too long, in my opinion, scientists have been focused on the dark side of our humanity, on our propensity to violence and selfishness and tribalism and mendacity. And they have overlooked what I think is the bright side, the fact that we have evolved these wonderful qualities, this ability to love each other and befriend each other and cooperate with each other and teach and learn from each other, for example. And my argument would be that on balance, the benefits of a connected life must have outweighed the costs, or we wouldn't be living the way we are living. We wouldn't be social animals. If whenever I came near you, you murdered me, or you lied to me, or you harmed me in some way, or you took advantage of me, I wouldn't stay connected to you. We wouldn't live as a social species. Instead, we would be a solitary species, but we're not. So the advantages had to be more than the disadvantages.
This is a book of evolutionary sociology. And a blueprint is the controlling metaphor of the book. Explain what you mean by a blueprint.
So I think what I mean by a blueprint is that natural selection has shaped a kind of fundamental way in which we go about living socially. Most people nowadays are familiar with the idea that natural selection and our genes guide the structure and function of our bodies. And people increasingly are also aware of the fact that natural selection and genetics can guide the structure and function of our minds. You know, whether you are risk averse or have wanderlust or have a musical taste in music, for example, your genes play some role in that. But what I argue is that natural selection and our genes also play a role not only in the structure and function of our bodies, not only in the structure and function of our minds and hence our behaviors, but also the structure and function of our societies.
So this is like we're pack animals on some level.
Not just that we're pack animals, that actually natural selection has equipped us with a whole set of fundamental qualities like the capacity for love or the capacity for friendship and the interest in those things or the taste in cooperation or in teaching and learning from each other. So we have this suite of traits, these actually good qualities that have been shaped by natural selection that allow us to live together in specific ways.
You write at one point about a social suite of kind of characteristics or predispositions. But you're also, I mean, when people start talking about evolution as the explanatory system for human behavior, a lot of times the radar goes up because you're not saying that people are genetically determined in an absolute way. You talk about pre-wiring rather than hardwiring.
Yes.
What is the distinction there and why is that very important?
Well, think about the fact that you might have a set of genes that specify how tall you might be when you grow up. But of course, if I raise you in an environment in which you're starved, you'll never achieve the height that you were, let's say, pre-wired to achieve. So there's no doubt the environment plays an enormous role in shaping the way you express a variety of traits. So just because people might have evolved to be cooperative species, if you are spend your whole life in a war-torn environment, you're going to be quite understandably very suspicious of other people. So the argument is that we're equipped with certain capacities which we are prone to manifest and express, but those can be reshaped. Now, I do argue and I do believe that, I mean, both nature and nurture are crucially important. Mm-hmm. I'm not a strict determinist, and I talk about that. But I do argue that we have been deluded by looking around the world and seeing all the tremendous variation in how people dress themselves and how they govern themselves and what sports they play and all of these traits. You know, anyone who's traveled has been abroad and has seen, you know, it smells different here and the food is different here and the people dress different here and they look different here. But I would argue that actually once you spend some time in that country, you begin to see that, oh my God, they love their partners like we do. They love their children like we do. They have friendships like we do. They're like us. You have a kind of an appreciation for our shared humanity, which comes very quickly. And so my argument is that we wrongly are deluded by what I would characterize as a thin veneer of civilization over a much more fundamental, bigger, deeper, more important set of principles that undergird how we live.
Right. You write towards the end of the book, modern societies are just the patina of civilization on top of this evolutionary blueprint. So that allows you to explain variation, but also commonality. Rehearse the history, though, of like we, you know, at least since the beginning of the 20th century, we seem to bounce back and forth between people who are strict determinists who will say, well, everything is genetic and, you know, that's it. And, you know, good luck if you're born dumb, you're never going to get smart or whatever, to people who say, no, we're absolute blank slates. Are you saying that we are now getting to a point where we're a little bit more grown up?
And
we can, you know, say it's a little bit of each, or these things work in connection.
I would hope so. I despair lately of the capacity of any kind of intellectual conversation in our society that tolerates shades of gray and nuance. But yes, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that it's both nature and nurture. There's also some more subtle ideas that people might want to understand, which can be nurture via nature. For example, we may be equipped with the capacity to reshape the environment around us. A trivial example of this might be, you might be the kind of person who's friendlier than others, and you will go about creating a friendly environment for yourself. Or you might be the kind of person, let's pick a simpler toy example, you might be the kind of person that's very cold intolerant. You don't like the cold, and so you start lighting fires. You build fires for yourself to reshape the environment around you. So the environment around you is different because, as it were, of your genes. So it's both. And they're even more complicated ideas that have to do with something known as gene culture coevolution. So the best example of this, the simplest example, the most famous example, is the example of lactase persistence. Lactase is an enzyme that digests lactose, a sugar, in milk. And ancestrally, in humans, the lactase was only present when we were infants, when we were suckling at our mother's breast and drinking milk. Once we were weaned, there was no reason for us to have the capacity to digest milk because there was no milk. We had no milk in our diet. But then around 10,000 years ago, we domesticate animals. All of a sudden in our environment, because of our cultural invention of domesticating animals, now milk is available for us to eat. Therefore, the ability to digest lactose into adulthood becomes advantageous. And scientists have shown that between the last 3,000 and 9,000 years, multiple times, mutations have arisen in the human line that make us capable of digesting milk. Now, what's amazing about this is that it suggests that cultural inventions of our making are reshaping evolution in historical time. So, for example, when we invent cities, we create a new environment for ourselves, which may advantage certain individuals. People with brains that make them better able to live in cities suddenly might be fitter, in a Darwinian sense, precisely because we've culturally have invented cities. So there may be many, many things. You know, we may all be more nearsighted, myself included, because of medieval lens grinders who made it possible for us to survive.
I'm wearing contacts now. I have no idea how humans existed without
you would have been
big,
eaten.
Thick eyeglasses.
Yes, you would have been long gone and have no progeny, and that would be the end of your line.
To pursue that a little bit more, in one chapter of the book, you talk about things, not even about kind of cultural things like cities or that kind of technology, but things like germline engineering, artificial intelligence, the way the internet or printing change things. Talk a little bit about how that kind of technology changes things, and should we be worried about this, or is it this is just what we do?
I mean, it's clearly the case that our technological innovations have always changed the fitness, the evolutionary environment. For example, when we invent fire, when we domesticate, you know, when we learn how to make fire, our bodies are different. We have smaller teeth now and shorter intestines because we mastered fire and therefore could cook our food, which made it possible for us to extract more calories from the food and not have to chew it as much or have the food spend as much time in our intestine. In other words, we pre-digest the food by heating it, okay? So, or we invented stone tools, right? You invent stone tools, it makes different body types better able that can handle weapons, for example. We invent weapons or cities, as we discussed. So it's clearly the case that across time, we humans have made innovations that have left their mark on our bodies and our genes. It's too early to tell with things like the internet or artificial intelligence, but I have no doubt that some scientists 10,000 years ago will look back at when we invented the internet and said that, you know, for example, here's an important feature. Since time immemorial, it's been very important for me to remember who people are and whether they are my friends or enemies. But if I have Google Glass and I can walk around and it will use facial detection algorithms to automatically detect people, bring up their biographies and say friend or foe, then that brain capacity that used to be important in me no longer is important and humans will evolve in a different direction. I think that's quite likely. Same with artificial intelligence in our midst. You know, if we start getting robotic intelligence in our midst, this technology will reshape our social interactions in ways that are probably bad, but could also be good.
Right. Or they just become a fact of nature. Then we have to deal with
that's
one
right.
or the other. Let's drill down a little bit on this. You know, a fascinating question of, so we have a common humanity, which
that's what I think.
Shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, it seems like we used to believe that, obviously, but then we have massive individual or group variation. Talk about the ways that some cultures are monogamous, polyandrous, polygynous. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that if we're really, all we really want is to be loved?
Yeah, so I think what lies at the core of this, we look around the world, for example. I mean, intimacy is a really fundamental and important part of human behavior.
It was until Pornhub.
So well, porn now, is yeah. another, well, actually, it's interesting. I think porn is a kind of hyperactive expression of a fundamental mm-hmm. human impetus.
And that, just to be clear, you're not being paid by Pornhub to say
I'm
that.
Not being paid
okay.
by anybody.
All right. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I'd be happy to. Yes, exactly. Give me $5.
Porn is one of the universal, it's part of that social
yeah,
suite.
Porn in Roman yeah. times, yes.
No, of course.
Porn goes way, way back.
But we do want intimacy. That's the root.
No, it's not that we want attachment. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's something, our species is unusual in that we have evolved the capacity not just to have sex with each other, but to be attached to each other. We have a kind of monogamy, actually. Now, 90% of bird species are monogamous. Relatively few mammalian species are monogamous. Monogamy is a kind of sustained social interaction with your mate. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, we don't need to have that quality to be able to reproduce, but we do. We stick around and we have a sentiment about our partners. This is also seen in certain other animals, certain other mammals, certain primates, and certain other long-lived mammals. We can go there. But anyway, we feel this way. Now, what's interesting, though, is that culturally, we have a tremendous variation in the kind of marital systems we manifest. So most societies historically have been polygynous, one man, many women. 1% have been polyandrous, one woman, many men. And there have been a goodly number of monogamous societies always.
Right.
And individuals who practice monogamy, too. But in all of these societies, underneath that is a sense of attachment we have to our mates. And that's a cultural universal. This capacity mm-hmm. to love the people we are reproducing with is a wonderful quality mm-hmm. that we have and is seen everywhere. There's one exception, which is the Na people of the Himalayas, who have a very, very strong cultural overlay that tries to stamp out. To foreigners, they seem like a very promiscuous society. Marco Polo describes them, the communists. So what they have is it's a matrilineal society in which women live with their matriline, with their mothers and their sisters and their aunts. And the men visit the household for furtive sexual encounters. And the women will pick who they want to have sex with. And it's not uncommon for a woman to have had sex with every man in the village. And nearby villages. And the women have total control over who they have sex with. the men are seen as doing a service, being nice to the women by having sex with them, and the children that are born live in that household. But even in this society, this whole elaborate set of cultural rules about this behavior is suppressing an innate desire to be together. Mm-hmm. And so the forbidden behavior in this society is to run away, forsaking all others, so two people can be together. This is the forbidden desire. And they do. Some couples like say, I just want to love you, and to hell with the society that forces me to be promiscuous. We're going to just be you and me, and they run away to be together.
And in all of these different cases, you talk about how kind of local conditions that might persist over centuries, but kind of shape all of this stuff.
Yes. Yes. So, but anyway, the thing is, there is no doubt there's tremendous cultural variation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the arguments that I like to make or point out is, the very fact that we are a cultural animal and that we are capable of manifesting mm-hmm. this cultural variation is itself a capacity we evolved to have. Mm-hmm. We evolved the capacity to learn socially, to acquire and transmit information, and to teach each other. This is very rare in the animal kingdom. So, for example, a little fish in the sea can learn that if it sees the light, it can swim up and there'll be food there. That's just individual learning. Social learning is when you learn from someone what some other organism is doing. So I can put my hand in the fire and learn that it's hot and pull it out, or you can put your hand in the fire. I see that you burn yourself. I acquire almost as much knowledge about the badness of fire, but pay none of the price. That's social learning. But we furthermore evolve the capacity to teach. I take you and I teach you about stuff. And this allows us to accumulate knowledge across time. It's the root of our capacity for culture. So I actually would turn the problem on its head, and I would say, this seeming variation that you see, this actual variation you see is itself a part of the social suite. We've evolved the ability to teach and learn from each other.
Tell me about your kind of intellectual genealogy or influences, because this type of applying evolution, you know, not strictly, but kind of in a metaphoric way, but in a real way, strikes me, you know, Friedrich Hayek talked about that,
yes.
But then there's a variety of, obviously, evolutionary biologists who talked about it. Where, you know, what are the roots of this for you?
Well, I've been trained both in the biological and the social sciences. I'm a physician and a sociologist. I was a hospice doctor for many years. I took care of people who were dying, and I also was trained in statistics and in computational sciences. And the work I've done in my lab over the last 20 years has been at the intersection of the biological, social, and computational sciences. And I don't know how much you want to know of the sequence of ideas.
Who are the influences? Who are the?
Well, there are lots of. Yeah. I mean, there were my teachers who I could name, who people might or might not recognize. Right. And there, of course, there are all the various thinkers who would take all day to list all the various people, various scientists, biologists, social scientists, philosophers, historians, anthropologists, economists. It goes on and on. One of the things that I try to do, as best I can as a scholar, is to try to integrate as much information about as many fields as possible. But I began my career as someone who was investigating decision making by physicians in difficult circumstances, initially in the intensive care unit. And I became very interested in prognosis, how people predict, how doctors predict what's going to happen to patients. This, in part, related to my own life experience as a young person growing up with a chronically ill, ultimately terminally ill mother. You know, my whole childhood was obsessed with when is she going to live or die. So, you know, I was obsessed with prognosis from a young age. I became a hospice doctor, which I think was counterphobic. You know, I was afraid of my mother's death. So what do? You go and expose yourself to death all the time. And so I spent the first few years of my career studying prognostication. And then I became interested in how to improve the care of the dying in our society. We still do a terrible job caring for the dying. Half of Americans die in pain. It should be a national travesty. And I started looking for ways to fix that. And then my wife came to me, my wonderful wife, It was about 1995 or 1996. And she said to me, look, this is getting ridiculous. You spend your whole day studying death and destruction. Could you please study something nicer? I was trying to think, what could I do that was sort of, you know, evolutionary based on the interests and strengths that I had? So I decided to study the widowhood effect, which is sort of, when I had just gone to England and someone told me a joke there, I'd gone to St. Christopher's Hospice where Cicely Saunders, the sort of the founding hospice of the hospice movement. And one person there told me a joke about how the Department of Vital Statistics, they called it hatch, match, and dispatch. Mm-hmm. So birth, marriage, right. and death. And I was studying dispatch. I couldn't study hatch, so I figured I'd study match. So I started studying the widowhood effect, which was the increased probability of the recent dying of a broken heart. The fact that when your partner dies, your risk of death goes up. I spent 5 years studying that. And that got me into social networks. And then beginning about almost 20 years ago now, 18 years ago now, I started studying human social interactions, starting with pairs, couples. Right. Actually. Anyway, so that's a little bit of the history, more than you probably care
well,
to know.
Well, no, it's fascinating. And, you know, at one point you write that humans are pre-wired to make a particular kind of society, one full of love, friendship, cooperation, and learning. To bring it to kind of the contemporary moment, you are, outside of your academic peers, you're best known for
yes.
starring in a video where a
yes.
bunch of students are screaming and yelling at
yes.
you. That's not quite a community of cooperation, love, and learning and whatnot.
No.
What is going on, do you think, on either on the college campus, and not to make too much out of that one instance, but and not simply about students, but intellectually, this idea that, well, we have a common, you know, we both have individual differences and a common humanity. This seems to be, nobody is talking this way. What's going on there?
All right, well, I would stridently defend the principle that we have a shared humanity and that, in fact, that's the vehicle by which we can come to understand each other. Because if you don't think that, if you think that my superficial traits define my beliefs and my ability to empathize or see the world, then why are we even talking? You know, why do we talk across lines? The whole idea, in my view, is that we have a shared humanity. We have the capacity for empathy, communication, sympathy, granting goodwill, the capacity to teach and learn from each other, and that these innate qualities that we have equip us with the capacity to communicate with each other. Otherwise, if you don't believe that, if you don't believe in our common humanity, if you don't believe in the shared humanity of all people, why don't we all just retreat to our corners and not bother to interact at all? First point. Second point. I think there is a serious problem in our society right now with certain fundamental liberal principles. I would put among those principles things that our founding fathers saw and that many other societies have also instantiated. For example, the freedom of assembly or the freedom of speech. Now, if you think about those Bill of Rights type qualities that the founding fathers, they are actually built on, even though they're Enlightenment principles, they're built on a deep evolutionary heritage. I mean, we've been talking about friendship, which relates to the freedom of assembly. We're a group living species. We like to pick our friends. The founding fathers knew better than to try to push against that. We like to teach and learn from each other. This is the source of our wisdom. In fact, it's the source of our wealth. In fact, it's the source of our survival. The fact that human beings can live in more varied environments than any other animal, I think, other than ants. So we have the social conquest of the earth. Our species has spread out to live everywhere from the equator to the poles. How did we do that? We do that because of our capacity for culture. We do that because of our capacity to teach and learn from each other. So if we do not foster a society of free speech, a society in which we are able to openly communicate with each other, we are, in a sense, swimming against this foundational reality.
Is it that things are worse now than they ever were, or is it that, because I you know, some critics of the university would say, well, you go back 40 or 50 years, there weren't a lot of different types of people on campuses.
Yes.
You know, there were white men, basically,
yes.
and that was it. And that what we're seeing now is there are more different voices, and
yes.
things have to change. Or so how do we get to a place where it's not just screaming matches or saying no to academic freedom or to intellectual heterodoxy?
No, I think the challenge is I totally endorse and support the democratization of admissions at American universities. I think these are institutions which belong to all. I think any student coming to any school should feel this is my place. I belong here. Mm-hmm. I have every right to this, just like I feel like any person. Now, we have in our society, we have often breached those ideals, alas. We have a long history of that. You know, we say that justice is blind. We know that justice has not been blind. There's been discriminatory practices with respect to, for example, if you're a minority group, you didn't get equal justice under the law. We had the principle, which I think is really admirable, and we've progressively gotten better. Our courts are less and less prejudiced against mm-hmm. minority groups, for example. And I think the same thing holds, for example, with our universities. It is, we have a principle of free and open expression. So I think, and we, a commitment to reasoned discourse, evidence-based instruction and debate, kind of civil kind of commitment to open expression. These are all foundational principles. So I think what we need to do is, as we appropriately democratize and open up the kinds of people that are coming to these institutions, as well we should, is inculcate in them a commitment to these beliefs. Welcome. This is an ancient and wonderful heritage that we have, a heritage devoted to these phenomenal, worth defending liberal principles. This commitment to reason, for example, this commitment to free expression, make them your own. And one of the hardest challenges I faced when I was at Yale back then, as you were alluding to, is I had a young woman, I think she was Native American, and she said to me in a public venue, she said, these constitutional liberties that you revere, these principles that you revere, were of no use to my people. They've been around for a long time, but they were no use to people that looked like me. What say you to that? And it was a really hard question. And in the moment, I couldn't think of an answer because, of course, she was right. You know, we had these principles, but we didn't honor them as we should have. And I think my answer to her eventually, in the form of an essay that I wrote and in the form of ideas that I have been thinking about in response to her query, is that you should, these principles are worth defending and you should make them your own. In fact, these are the principles you are using right now to rectify the inequality that was there before.
So this is, I mean, using the master's tools to both kind of deconstruct his house and then rebuild it in a more inclusive way.
Yes, and these tools, you know, you don't need to be a Luddite, right? You don't need to destroy, you don't need to throw the baby out. I don't know what the right metaphor is, the baby out with the bathwater. And I think, you know, I think you see this right now, for example, with, there's a big debate happening right now, actually at Harvard, about the commitment to the presumption of innocence and that everyone deserves an attorney. You know, that if you defend a criminal, maybe you're a bad person.
Right. And this is, there's a law professor who is defending Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, Harvey Weinstein.
And there has been a petition to kick him out of the school.
Kick him out, yes. Yeah. Now, from my perspective, we have a long commitment in our society to drawing a distinction between being a defense attorney, because everyone needs a defense. We believe that we have a system of courts and laws and that you're innocent until proven guilty. And we have always seen being a defense attorney as an honorable performance, right. An honorable occupation. And if anything, we should be deeply suspicious of the idea that, oh, if the police accuse you, you must be guilty. Mm-hmm. Actually, this false belief has been used to the detriment of downtrodden parts of our population since time immemorial. Quite the opposite. So the commitment to these fundamental liberal principles, innocent until proven guilty. We have an impartial judiciary that everyone needs a lawyer. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with being a lawyer, even for people who are accused of horrible things. Freedom of expression, civil discourse, voting, right? Compromise.
So
these things, unfortunately, seem to be at a kind of ebb right now.
Yeah, what do you think goes into that ebb? Like, why is it happening? And then what are, you know, beyond, and it might just be this, reciting these and reminding people of the value of this, you know, how do we get to a better place where there is more academic heterodoxy, where there's more interest in trying new ideas, there's more interest in having more discussions that are inclusive rather than a few that are very much in a kind of Jeremiah fashion.
Well, I mean, The Onion had a fantastic piece that that said something like, you know, universities strongly support discussions of an idea, you know, just one idea. We're all going to discuss that one idea. Yeah. We can't, you know. I don't have any kind of special purchase on what ails our society, what causes the ailments of our society today. The ailments we face are ailments we faced before, a kind of splintering of a commonweal, a kind of us versus them, a kind of zero-sum politics, a kind of loss of the ability to compromise, a kind of name-calling, which I find ridiculous. You know, I have friends across the political spectrum. I have one libertarian friend who I adore, who is a very deep thinker and really challenges me, and who, you know, I often don't have answers to his ideas, but it makes me think, actually. I had
the answer, by the way, is always just end the Fed.
And the Fed, no,
and
right.
The and Fed, the Fed, and then, well, then has, you can just get on.
No, but
with
he
that.
Has, but he has ideas like, you know, he'll come up with, you know, we've talked about all kinds of things with him, everything from arguments about the private ownership of roads to, for example, whether blackmail should be illegal or not, and what is the reason we make it a crime, actually. And you know, he'll put me on my back feet, and I think anyway. My point is not him specifically, although he's a very smart and man who challenges my thinking a lot. My point is that by exposing oneself to many political beliefs, you know, the famous Mill statement: "He who knows only his own side of the case knows little of it." If you aren't being challenged, if you aren't debating other people with very dissimilar views, you don't really understand your case. And so I think this kind of stridency, and in fact, even in martial arts, you know, why do you bow to your opponent? You thanking your opponent, right? Your opponent is a source of learning from you. And so, you know, I really believe these ideas. I'm not just saying them. And I learn more from arguing with people who I disagree with. And I enjoy agreeing with my friends, of course, everyone does. But anyway, so I think that we have to, we were identifying. So what ails our society is this lack of compromise, lack of tolerance, all of this stuff. We've had this before. I don't think this will last forever. But I don't have any special insights into why we're going through that phase again.
Or when it might end.
Well, typically these things don't last more than half a generation. You know, I think 10 years maybe or 15 years we'll have this. And then, you know, we'll sort of sort it out. It'll be like after the 100 Years' War, there was peace in Europe for a while.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Nicholas Christakis. He's the author most recently of Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. Thanks for talking.
Nick, thank you for having me.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And watch the video version of this by going to Reason.tv. Thanks for listening.